Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome to TechEd 2012. Hopefully, you're enjoying yourself. Today's session, we'll be focusing on designing a private cloud infrastructure, and the focus will be on optimizing SQL Server within the private cloud, and it's going to be based upon a financial services organization. So it's a real-life case study where we'll definitely share tips, best practices, and designs affiliated with a customer implementation that both myself, Ross Mystery, and my colleague Majanath Anjapur did for a customer. With that being said, I'll start with a quick introduction. My name is Ross Mystery, I'm one of the principal enterprise architects at Microsoft. I work at our Microsoft Technology Center in Silicon Valley. I'm also an author of many different books ranging from SQL Server and Windows. And before joining Microsoft, I was a SQL Server MVP. Now, with regards to what I typically do at our Microsoft Technology Center, I focus on strategy briefings, design sessions, and proof of concepts where we design solutions similar to this for our largest customers within the West region. You're welcome to follow me on Twitter at Ross Mystery, or I also co-manage our SQL Server Twitter account. You're welcome to follow that also. If you have any questions, feel free to contact me on Twitter, or you're welcome to visit my website and obtain information from there also.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Manjanath Anjapur, and I'm the lead data center strategist from Microsoft in Northern California. And I focus primarily working with our enterprise customers around things like Windows Server, virtualization, and our systems management technologies. So Ross and I co-managed a project with one of our financial services customers to deploy SQL Server on Hyper-V and being managed by our System Center suite of products. You can follow me on Twitter as well, as Ross mentioned, and my Twitter account is mentioned in there. So I look forward to talking to you again later in the session.
Thank you. All right, so what we're going to focus on is, firstly, I wanted to do a quick private cloud overview. The main thing, again, we're going to share the best practices, the tips, but there's a lot of misconceptions with regards to what exactly is a private cloud, specifically when working with Microsoft private cloud technology. So we definitely want to spend a few minutes around that just to demystify some of the misconceptions affiliated with what a private cloud is. The next thing what we want to do, again, is share the best practices and tips. Therefore, you can attend the session. However, you can relate to what we've done with our customer if you are going down the path of creating a private cloud infrastructure specifically for your SQL Server environment. So we'll definitely showcase planning tips, what type of tools you should utilize. Therefore, if you're trying to get a holistic view of your existing environment, you'll understand your existing environment, understand the tools to utilize, and then go right into the design. And in the design, we're going to showcase, again, what we did with this customer specifically around compute, storage, networking, and best practices with regards to even how to achieve high availability within a SQL Server private cloud environment, or how do I achieve best practices with regards to around optimization. So how do I leverage the self-service capabilities to do template installations of SQL Server? So again, the goal here is to showcase, share best practices and tips. We definitely welcome questions, so feel free to walk up to the mic if you do have a question throughout the session. If not, towards the end of the session, we'll definitely spend some time with regards to opening up the floor for additional questions. Before we do start, I just want to get a show of hands. Who's coming in here from a SQL Server side of things? So your SQL Server DBA, SQL Server individual managing SQL Server. And on the flip side, when you do design a private cloud solution, specifically around SQL Server, a lot of times it's going to be based upon individuals who are in from the infrastructure side. So who here is not working with SQL Server but are from the infrastructure side? So you work with Windows, storage, networking. Good. So it looks like a good mix of people, 50-50 or so. So hopefully there's no wars in the crowd and we'll all be happy. But I think when you go down these routes of designing a private cloud solution, similar to what we did, we definitely have to interact with one another to ensure that we do follow best practices, because there's a lot of different items involved from a storage, from infrastructure, and to the SQL Server side of things, specifically around optimization. So that being said, I'm going to start. Firstly, what I want to talk about, as I mentioned earlier, is strictly a private cloud overview. So I think a lot of us have attended Satya's keynote, or maybe we attended MMS session, and we understand what a private cloud is, but I do want to spend a few minutes going over what a private cloud solution is. Now, at our Microsoft Technology Center, I do a lot of executive briefings with customers. We spend a lot of time with C-level executives. I believe cloud-based solutions is top of mind, where a lot of individuals want to implement a cloud-based solution over the next 1 to 2 years. Now, with this mandate, they typically work with the infrastructure folks or SQL Server. Everyone understands, yes, I want to design a private cloud solution. However, they look at one another and they're like, okay, now I know what I need to do, but what exactly is a private cloud and how should I do it? So the things that I get sometimes is, okay, is private cloud strictly maybe SQL Server, Azure in a container on premise? Is Microsoft managing it? Am I managing it? With that being said, Manjunath, that's curious to know. A lot of people will tell me, hey, private cloud is strictly virtualization. Is that so?
Not really. So I don't know if you agree with that statement. Is private cloud purely just virtualization, or does it take something beyond virtualization? In my opinion, and the way Microsoft defines a private cloud is that it is a key enabler for these four scenarios that are shown on this slide. One is that it has to have some modality of self-service. So I, as the end user or the line of business application owner, need to be able to provision and deprovision services that I need on when I need them on demand. Second is that it has to be usage-based, meaning there's some method of cost control, showback or chargeback back to the business to help us determine whether or not the services and the SLAs we are providing back to the business are indeed meeting those criteria. The third aspect is really enabling the entire compute infrastructure that includes storage, networking, compute, and sometimes even the people resources to be able to dynamically go up and down based on the ever-changing needs of the business. So, you know, let's say you're in a marketing organization and holiday season comes up, you want to be able to spike your load at, you know, around Thanksgiving or Christmas time. At that time, you need to be able to provision servers, scale them out, and then once the holiday season is over, you need to be able to scale them back down. And you don't do this manually, but you let the system automatically determine the load and load balance based on that. So really, the idea of private cloud is just taking virtualization and building upon that foundation. Does that make sense?
Yes, definitely makes sense. And just to correlate it back to some of the stuff from SQL Server perspective, let's say you're looking at pooled resources. So firstly, within a SQL Server environment, the trend over the past, let's say, 5 to 10 years would be consolidate utilizing multiple instance failover configurations. And in these situations, you would definitely put a lot of databases onto a single instance. And even with the specific customer, we may be in a situation where you have 1,000 databases on a specific instance. However, you do not achieve pooled resources in this fashion because you lose the potential for like database portability. So I think that's something very important within a private cloud. Or the elasticity where you have the ability to scale on demand and at the same time scale back. So a very common theme I would have with the customer would be we fire up all these SQL Server instances from a prototyping perspective. And at the end of the day, we're suffering from SQL Server sprawl in a virtualized environment. So ultimately, what we're trying to do here is, through a self-service capability and interacting that with the workflow, I may be able to have a business user select a SQL Server system. They want it up and running for only 2 months. At the end of the two-month process, I can have a workflow which emails this customer within the organization or externally and says, okay, are you finished your specific opportunity with regards to your prototype? If yes, hit the checkbox, send an email, and I can automatically deprovision this environment and provide the resources back to the private cloud. Therefore, they can be allocated to other SQL Server workloads. So I think it's a very important aspect with regards to the attributes affiliated with the private cloud. Another thing, that a very common item that we come against is individuals, even though they're within their own organization, they're providing they need to provide usage-based back to their business customers or even their external customers. So a situation would be, if I have a private cloud, I might have 100 SQL Server instances, and these are tailored towards marketing, finance. But we need to understand who is utilizing these resources by creating some form of reports. And these reports can be utilized from a chargeback model. Maybe I'm charging how much memory, how much processor an individual is using. Or at the same time, if I'm not charging them, I may use it for a showback. So again, I'd say these are four attributes affiliated with cloud computing that could be actually private or public. The next thing I'm looking at also is private cloud drivers. So why should I design a private cloud? So why are these conversations top of mind for many C-level executives? The one I'd say would be agility. So again, many individuals are using database consolidation through multiple instances. But again, if I want to move a database from one instance to another, I have to schedule downtime. I may have did a backup or a restore to detach and attach, But again, in a private cloud environment, if I'm suffering performance degradation on a SQL Server instance, I can press a button and move that SQL Server instance from one Hyper-V host to another Hyper-V host, or even allocate additional memory to that specific instance if I'm suffering performance degradation. So I think having an agile environment in the Dynamics data center is a very important aspect. The next thing would be economics. So again, I think most individuals or most organizations are forced the mandate, you know, do more with less. And specifically in a bifurcated economy such as we have right now, again, the goal is to reduce total cost of ownership. You reduce total cost of ownership, you increase your hardware utilization, and eventually you move towards innovation, meaning the DBAs or the infrastructure architects in the room no longer have to focus on remedial tasks. They can focus on more strategic initiatives throughout the year, such as designing or implementing a private cloud. So with regards to, with regards to part two, what I want to focus on is private cloud planning. So what we did with a specific customer in order to achieve success in designing a private cloud. The first step was understanding the existing environment. And the existing environment for this specific financial services customer included hundreds of instances of SQL Server running on physical topology. And the SQL Server systems were on SQL 2000, 2005, 2008, 2008 R2. As you can see, there was a lot more 2008 R2s coming into play because there was a goal of consolidating on the latest and greatest platform at the time. We started designing the solution last year with the intent that eventually we'll utilize SQL 2012, but the goal is ultimately utilize SQL Server 2008 R2. The operating system memory ranged from approximately 4 gigs to 48 gigs on the actual physical servers. We had approximately 2,000 databases across hundreds of instances. They were leveraging System Center within their existing environment. However, they weren't utilizing System Center 2012. We'll talk about how we utilize Virtual Machine Manager 2012 for self-service provisioning of the SQL Server instances, the databases, including the guest operating system. Majority of the servers were backed against the SAN, and there was a separation of duties between the environment. We had DBAs, we had the server platform engineering, each of them working autonomously, but the goal was to get them together, but at the same time include role-based security in the management of the solution. With regards to the official customer goals affiliated with this project, we had, as I mentioned, hundreds of instances, but we decided, okay, we're not going to move everything to the private cloud. Some specific instances didn't even fit within the private cloud, but the goal is we'll go after low-hanging fruit. So we decided we're going to virtualize tier two, tier three environments into the private cloud infrastructure. We want to increase manageability by standardizing on a single operating system and SQL Server version. So at the time, it was SQL Server 2008 R2 on Windows 2008 R2, and we want to take advantage of some of the private cloud features, which we'll definitely discuss. We want to reduce total cost of ownership within the environment and increase hardware utilization across the existing environment. We want to dynamically support projected growth of approximately 30% per year. Therefore, if we're going to grow by 30% a year, we didn't want to be in a situation where we have to redesign the solution from scratch, but we should easily be able to have that agile or dynamic data center where we can easily take advantage of the existing private cloud infrastructure to support that growth. Definitely want to maintain separation of duties. And some of the things that we also looked at was technology driven. So again, we want to be able to pool the resources such as compute, storage, networking, and allocate them as logical units for our SQL Server infrastructure within the private cloud. We want to dynamically provision and scale database applications. So as opposed to me throwing in an ISO or a DBD, I want to be able to automatically or rapidly provision the guest operating system, the SQL Server instance, right down to the database automatically through a self-service type solution. And finally, what we were looking at is when we standardize on SQL Server 2008 R2 and Windows 2008 R2, we also want to look at how do I achieve high availability and disaster recovery for these mission-critical databases. So with that being said, we're looking at some of the planning toolkits. So we start off by utilizing the MAP toolkit to identify SQL Server sprawl. Now, the MAP toolkit is ultimately Microsoft's assessment and planning toolkit. And for those who have not utilized it before, you can download it for free from Microsoft's website. And it's a great tool to conduct a holistic inventory of your SQL Server instances. In addition to that, you can also collect performance metrics, which we did. So we want to understand the processor, the memory, the disk, and the tempdb usage, because these specific metrics were utilized in order to plan the private cloud infrastructure, meaning how much servers we should purchase, how much cores we should utilize, how much memory is required. In addition to that, since we want to standardize on Windows Server 2008 R2, what we also wanted to take advantage of utilizing the SQL Server Upgrade Advisor. Now, the SQL Server Upgrade Advisor is another tool which you can download for free, and it can analyze this existing SQL Server installation to ensure that there's no blockers. Therefore, if I'm trying to migrate to the latest and greatest, I would have continuity to ensure that I won't have any issues with regards to the upgrade. There's a question in the front, sir.
What is the impact of dramatic on the servers running?
I'm sorry, what was that?
What is the impact?
Oh, the impact. Impact. Sure.
So, from an impact perspective, it's really minimal. What it does is utilize existing protocols such as WMI and other underlying protocols that are already in the box. And you can schedule this over a period of time. Obviously, if you do it performance collection over just a 30-minute window, then all you're doing is getting a snapshot. But this is a pretty comprehensive tool in that it'll wait for things that are potentially offline to come back online and do the analysis at that time. I've done this dozens of times, if not hundreds, and I've not had any complaints in terms of the impact.
And we'll show a demonstration of the map toolkit so we can showcase how to scan a specific Active Directory environment or a subnet, therefore you can minimize on performance within the scan itself. Another question in the front? Sure. So the question is...
To repeat the question, if I heard it correctly, what authentication you need or... what authority do I need on the target servers? It depends on the target server itself. The map toolkit has the ability to inventory and do performance analysis on not just SQL Server, but also Windows servers, MySQL, other databases, Oracle instances, ESX servers, et cetera. So just to recognize SQL Server is running, you need SSL privileges on the SQL box to really understand what's going on that on the database instance.
Okay. So the next thing I want to focus on, the key findings affiliated with the map toolkit and the metrics collected. So with regards to what we did is, once we ran the map toolkit, we utilized this information to help design the private cloud solution. So with the hundreds of instances that we're analyzing and scanning, we had the ability to understand that of the CPUs, there's approximately 4 to 8 cores on each of the boxes, but the CPU utilization was less than 10%. The memory usage per instance of SQL Server ranged from 2 to 64 gigs, but on medium, we're looking at approximately 4 gigs of memory for each of the SQL Server instances. And finally, the total storage affiliated with the environment was approximately 5 terabytes, and the IOPS ranged by approximately 30 to 10,000 IOPS based upon each of the environments. So I think in order to help visualize the map toolkit, we can showcase how to utilize it and demonstrate a report affiliated with the maps toolkit.
So what you're seeing here is the UI for the Microsoft Assessment and Planning Toolkit. On the left side here, you have the ability to do inventory and assessment of machines, applications, desktops, databases. And as I mentioned earlier, it can be either SQL Server, MySQL, Oracle, or Sybase. What it'll do is allow you to do a performance analysis, do an inventory first, follow that by doing a performance analysis over a period of time. And this time could be anywhere ranging from 30 minutes to a week to a couple of weeks as well, so that you get a pretty comprehensive view of what the performance is for the entire environment. So very straightforward. In order to do an inventory, all you have to do is choose what you want to really inventory. In this case, I've chosen Windows servers and as well as SQL. But you can see the plethora of other tools, other systems, rather, that can be inventoried. Once I do that, I choose what method I want to use to discover the environment. Typically, if you are in an Active Directory environment, you choose the Active Directory domain services. But you can even give a text file with a range of IP addresses if you so choose. Or import a text file with the names of the machines. Thereafter, you provide the Active Directory credentials. And let me go ahead and type my credentials in here.
I think also when you're doing these type of scans, it's beneficial to not only understand the processor memory and disk affiliated with each SQL Server instance, but to also understand the tempdb usage. I think that comes into play specifically when consolidating multiple databases within a single instance.
So once I've entered the credentials, I can choose which computers I want to use for discovery. Go ahead and then provide credentials based on the target. I think this goes to the gentleman's question earlier. Based on the target that I've chosen, I can choose credentials for either SQL Server itself or credentials for WMI. Obviously, if I'm doing WMI credentials, I will need domain admin privileges on the target so that it is able to understand the core underlying kernel level performance metrics. For SQL, you'll need SA privileges so that it understands what databases are available on that instance or multiple instances of SQL running on that box. Once you do that, and I'm not going to go through the entire report here, it goes around, collects the inventory, and for machines that are potentially offline, you can have a retry interval for how long the inventory is going to run for. Once all that is done, I'm going to close this wizard here. What you end up with is reports such as this. You get the instance names, database names, connection status, usernames, and I'm going to scroll here, user IDs, all that kind of good stuff. But more importantly, what you'll also get is important information on what versions of SQL are running, what service packs, whether they're clustered or not clustered. So you can see pretty comprehensive view of what kind of CPUs, how much memory, what kind of disk space is allocated. And it actually provides recommendations, how many host processors, what's the status of WMI, et cetera. So not only does it provide an Excel spreadsheet, but it also provides a very easy-to-use Word document that you can provide to your executives on what really you need to do to either consolidate or virtualize your SQL instances. So the Excel spreadsheet for us are more on the engineering side, and a very nice Word document already pre-formatted and ready for you to send to your executives.
Thank you. All right, so next we're going to move into part three, which is ultimately how do we utilize the information from the planning toolkit to actually design the private cloud infrastructure?
So we talked earlier about what the underlying environment was. You know, Ross talked about how we collected the inventory. And our goal, as we mentioned earlier, was to focus on the tier two and tier three workloads. And the team came up with a goal, initial goal, of about 100 SQL instances that they needed to virtualize on Hyper-V. And standardization would be around SQL Server 2008 R2, running on Windows Server 2008 R2 with Service Pack 1. And the reason we chose Service Pack 1, again, not only is it obviously the latest and greatest service pack for the operating system, but more importantly, to utilize a feature called dynamic memory, which I'll talk about later. Just for a show of hands, how many of you have heard about dynamic memory on Hyper-V? One, two, good. So a few of you have heard about that. We'll talk about how we ended up utilizing dynamic memory together with SQL's own memory management techniques to get the most benefit out of this environment. Server Core, which is an installation option in Windows Server 2008 R2, was used as a base operating system. In Windows Server 2012, that you've heard about at this TechEd here, allows you to flip between Server Core and the full installation. Essentially, you have the shell, and then you can have a GUI on top of it. On Windows Server 2008 R2, that's really not an option. You choose at installation time whether you want a Server Core installation, which is really a minimal disk footprint installation with a command line as a GUI, or you can choose a full installation. In this case, for security and disk management purposes, we chose a server core installation option. And in terms of migrating existing workloads on databases, we chose not to do a P2V or a physical to virtual, but rather do a migration of those databases using existing SQL Server database migration tools. The environment, based on our assessment of the existing physical instances, was that we ended up designing a 6-node Windows cluster that is hosting Hyper-V. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with the way we do failover cluster services in Windows Server 2008 R2, it's a lot, it's leaps and bounds better, more enhanced than what you may have been used to in the older Windows Server 2003 Microsoft clustering services. The amount of time it'll take you to set up a cluster and create a cluster and validate the cluster is really reduced by orders of magnitude. From a high availability perspective, the decision was to provide high availability at the virtual machine layer, not at the individual SQL instance layer. So in case there's a SQL instance that needs to have a high availability, there will be other options through mirroring or obviously in the case of SQL Server 2012, through always-on technologies. But in this case, we chose to provide high availability at the virtual machine layer. We also had the notion of providing only one SQL instance per virtual machine. That does simplify things, and I realize that is probably not the norm in most of your environments. But in this case, that is what the customer wanted to start off with, and get the warm fuzzies using this environment, and then scale up from there. The management infrastructure, which I'll be talking about in a few minutes, was really not part of this cluster itself. This cluster of 6 nodes is dedicated primarily to host these 100 instances and grow at about 30% a year. And finally, we talked about the ability to segregate the creation of these nodes, the management of the nodes itself, the core underlying infrastructure, versus what a lot of you as DBAs would like to do, which is service your application owners by provisioning databases. So we created a workflow so that there's approvals and checkboxes and check really, in for lack of a better term, checks and balances built into the process to ensure that the underlying OS is provisioned, and then through a method in our System Center tool, we allow the DBAs to self-service the provisioning of virtual machines. Based on the reports we got from the MAP toolkit, we determined that we'll need about a total of 300 cores. And in the virtualized environment, obviously these are not physical cores, these are virtual CPUs. And this was predicated on the fact that, based again on the MAPS tool, the Microsoft Assessment and Planning Toolkit, we determined that a lot of the SQL instances were utilizing less than 10% of the CPU on an 8-core machine. Now, how many of you in the room kind of feel that way, that most of your machines are underutilized from a SQL environment? Just a few? Right.
I would say it's a common theme in a lot of consolidated infrastructures.
So the goal, again, is to maximize the investment from a business perspective. If you're paid for the super-duper, latest 8-core machine, why not use the capacity to its maximum? And that's where we determined that providing a conservative overcommit ratio of 8-to-1, which Hyper-V today allows, and obviously that changes in Windows Server 2012, we removed that 8-to-1 limit. It's pretty much unlimited, but in Windows Server 2008 R2, we can allocate up to 8 virtual CPUs for every logical CPU on the physical box. Does that make sense? So every virtual CPU can then be allocated to one or more virtual machines that are running on that host. With about 100 instances and about with a core dedicated to each, and we decided that one core is really probably the not the norm, but we wanted to start there and see how much we are able to tax the environment. Remember that most of the machines were underutilizing the CPU, so we were not CPU bound. Where we were bound was in disk. It was not CPU, it was not memory, it was disk. So I'll talk a little bit about what we did on the disk side as well. So when you're trying to allocate or provision these machines, the best practice I would recommend is really look at your budget, find out what's the maximum number of cores and hardware that you can get out for that particular environment, and go ahead and acquire that, because you can never anticipate whether it's going to be 10%, 20%, or 30% growth down the road. From a memory design perspective, we ended up using dynamic memory. For those of you who are not familiar with dynamic memory, it is the ability of the hypervisor to load balance the memory across all the virtual machines so that no one particular virtual machine is ever starved for memory. We do not break the laws of physics and create new physical memory where none exists. We do not overcommit memory. What we do is oversubscribe memory. And that allows us to scale up and scale down the memory requirements based on what the SQL instances demand. So one of the things I learned through this process, not being primarily on the systems management and Windows side, is that SQL likes to do its own CPU and memory management. So you've got this CPU and memory management going on the SQL instance, and you've got the underlying operating system trying to manage memory up and down as well. So one of the things you've got to watch out for is to ensure that you're setting up your SQL instances in a manner so that they're able to release memory when the underlying operating system requests that memory needs to be released, so that that memory can then be utilized for other virtual machines. And there are settings in SQL Server in terms of what it can do with the lock pages in memory, user rights for the SA account, for the service account for SQL, that allow you to determine whether or not SQL will lock those memory pages or release those memory pages on demand. The screenshot here really shows what the startup maximum memories can be, what the range of those memory is on a per VM basis. Question here. You do, and that's where the memory buffer you see here. I don't know if I have a laser pointer. Oh, the question was, when I allocate memory for the virtual machine, do I need to provide for the underlying operating system as well? Was it the right? Right. So there's two levels of memory allocation. One is memory allocation within the virtual machine itself for the OS of the virtual machine, right? Okay. And the second is, amongst all the virtual machines, how much memory should be set aside for the hypervisor itself. So I'll talk about the first. I think that's where your question is. The amount of memory you allocate for SQL can be configured within the SQL UI itself, the max and min that SQL will use. The recommendation is that you want to have the max memory allocated within SQL to be about 20% lower than what you have allocated for the entire VM. So you want a little bit of memory for the virtual machine's operating system itself. What if you've got some layered products on there? What if you've got antivirus or backup tools that need the memory, right? Oh, before I move to the next slide, one of the things to keep in mind is that, you know, a lot of the newer server architectures obviously are NUMA aware, and looking forward to Windows Server 2012, within the virtual machines themselves, we are respecting NUMA architecture. So while we respect NUMA architecture on the physical environment, what we are doing is respecting that within the virtual machine. So all the NUMA architectures and the node affinities on the server platform are exposed at the virtualized layer as well in Windows Server 2012. So to protect your investment moving forward, I would recommend that if you are using NUMA architecture, to work with your hardware vendor to ensure that the DIMM slots are properly allocated against the CPUs that they're targeting. From a disk perspective, and I mentioned that we determined that disk was really the bottleneck. Within Hyper-V, you've got three different methods by which you can set up disks. One is known as a dynamic disk. And this is not dynamic disk from an OS perspective. The disk on Hyper-V is a virtual hard drive or a VHD file. This VHD file can be of two flavors. One is a dynamic disk. The other is what is known as a fixed disk. A dynamic disk allows for growth on demand. So the sectors are not zeroed out when the disk is initially created. When the operating system or the application requests additional disk, it is going to go ahead and request that as needed. It is pretty highly performant, but it is not as highly performant as what we call a fixed disk. A fixed disk will pre-allocate and zero out all the sectors already for you so that when the application requires that extra disk space, it's already there. Both of these options give about 95 to 98% performance of what you would get with physical disk. You get about 99% of performance of physical disk when you go with what is known as a pass-through disk. What a pass-through disk allows you to do is take instructions, you know, storage I/O instructions from the virtual machine directly to the underlying storage hardware, bypassing the hypervisor altogether. So obviously, as you reduce the number of layers, you know, we increase the performance of the environment. So my recommendation is to use pass-through disks. Now, our storage management tools within System Center allow for what is known as storage classification. So you may, you know, remember we talked about the ability to have self-service in your environment. The self-service could be based on certain SLAs. I've got a tier 2 workload. Does that mean that I need tier 1 storage? Probably not. I need tier 2 storage to go with tier 2 workloads. So the systems management tools that we have allow you to pre-classify the storage so that when you do self-service and you request the provisioning and creation of virtual machines and SQL instances on top of those virtual machines, the system already knows which storage arrays to go talk to. So that was an important consideration. Third area was that the OS itself is going to boot from SAM. So the OS, there's no local disks. These were blade chassis. There's no local disk on the blade. The choice was to boot the underlying hypervisor and Windows Server operating system directly from the SAN itself. And the SAN had 8 gigabyte fiber channel, and Yet another best practice I would recommend is go talk to your storage vendor, whether it's EMC, NetApp, Hitachi, your choice of storage vendors. Each one of them have published best practice guidance on how to carve out storage for Hyper-V, and Hyper-V being the underlying hypervisor upon which all of this is running. Their documentation is very comprehensive in how many spindles to allocate, how many LUNs per VM, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it differs from storage vendor to storage vendor. So please go talk to your storage vendor on that.
So other things from a storage perspective, when we were designing private cloud solutions for other customers, we've been in situations where we utilize tiered storage and created storage pools and even utilize SSD shelves. Therefore, I know from a database perspective, at times it gets challenging to understand the I/O workload affiliated with the database and where to place that virtual machine across the cluster shared volume in the private cloud. So what we've done in the past with other customers, we'd have tiered storage with the fast cache within the tiered storage, and the SAN provider itself would dynamically move blocks affiliated with the SQL VM from specific tiered storage, perhaps even to an SSD shelf after hours. Therefore, it helped us in the design phase where we'd minimize the amount of placements of these VHDs across different CSVs. So that's something else to take into consideration if you have this type of architecture or topologies affiliated with your SAN solutions.
So we're just check the clock, so we need to move along a little
sure,
here.
Sure.
From the networking standpoint, what I've highlighted here are best practices from Microsoft for how to set up networking. You need one network for the management of the underlying infrastructure itself. You need a network for doing live migration of these virtual machines from one node in the cluster to another node in the cluster. You need a network for the interconnect between the clusters nodes themselves to ensure that there's heart beating signals going from one node to the other. And then for the production environment itself, you know, this is where the SQL instances are residing. You could have 1 to X number of networks depending upon whether or not you have security considerations, bandwidth considerations, et cetera, again, based on the SLAs and the types of workloads that you have. You do have the ability to provide for NIC teaming, specifically 802.3AED NIC teaming already available, and then support for hardware-based quality of service. All of that is available either directly from the operating system or through vendor-provided solutions.
So the next piece we're going to focus on, optimizing SQL Server within the private cloud. And the main goal here is really how do we achieve high availability and how do we achieve self-service capabilities? So first off, what we're going to focus on is, as Manjunath mentioned earlier, we ultimately stay towards best practices and maintain a single SQL Server instance per VM. Therefore, we didn't have to configure multiple instances within an environment. So we stick to one SQL Server instance per VM. We also leveraged the live migration feature. Therefore, we could achieve high availability for the guest operating system, and the guest we could actually have a SQL Server instance move from one Hyper-V host to another Hyper-V host without any perceived downtime from an application's perspective. Now, we also looked at guest clustering versus live migration and also looked at futures. Therefore, with the intent that SQL Server 2012 would come down, we may use availability groups to achieve both high availability and disaster recovery for the SQL Server databases. However, for this specific environment, we also took advantage of the technologies that they already had in play. So they were utilizing disaster recovery technologies from a SAN perspective. Therefore, we leveraged that to achieve the DR of the VMs between the private cloud environments. This is sort of off topic from the specific customer, but I think it's very important to understand. Again, many customers will work with us how to achieve high availability within a private cloud environment, and I really want to call out the three alternatives available. So the first alternative that many organizations will take advantage of is live migration. As I mentioned earlier, live migration would be you have a SQL Server VM residing on one Hyper-V host within the private cloud. I can move that Hyper-V host from one, I can move that SQL Server VM from one Hyper-V host to another Hyper-V host without any perceived downtime. It protects the guest operating system. However, if I want to patch SQL Server, if I want to put on a service pack, or I want to upgrade SQL Server from one version to another, I will have downtime. I cannot protect against those type of planned installations. Therefore, individuals may go to a next layer, which would be known as guest clustering. And with guest clustering, ultimately what I'm building here is a traditional cluster where I have more than one node within the SQL Server failover cluster. However, each of these nodes do not reside on a physical server. Each node is virtualized on a guest operating system. So we didn't use this specific solution for our customer because it does require an iSCSI target between the guest operating systems in order to achieve high availability. However, many customers will go this route because I can now do rolling upgrades. So I can move to the passive node, install SQL Server Service Pack 1, for example, and then fail over and fail back. So I'm minimizing downtime through a rolling upgrade process. The next thing we also looked at was availability groups. So the goal here would be for many customers, this specific customer, but many other customers I design private cloud solutions for at our Microsoft Technology Center, the goal really is how do I achieve high availability disaster recovery natively without the third-party tools? So that may not have a SAN replication topology in place. So what we typically do is you'd have two private cloud environments, let's say one in San Francisco, one in New York as a disaster recovery solution. Then what I'd do is I'll have my VMs within the private cloud, and then I'd install the SQL Server 2012 always on availability groups. We utilize a synchronous commit within the primary data center and an asynchronous commit to the secondary data center. Therefore, I achieve high availability within the San Francisco site, and if that private cloud goes down, I need to fail over. I have the potential to fail over to the New York site, and all my VMs are operational. Again, this is utilizing native tools as opposed to any third-party tools from a Windows and a SAN perspective. So again, there are three alternatives available, but we chose the route of live migration for this one specific customer.
So the next area that we want to focus on is how did we provide self-service? Remember that self-service is one of the key tenets of providing the private cloud solution. And we decided that we'll have three kinds of what we call service templates, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. A service template is an encapsulation of what you want on the OS, how much memory you need, what kind of CPU you need, and I'll do a brief demonstration of that in a few minutes. But we essentially came up with three kinds of templates, small, medium, and large, and you can read what the details of each of those were. So if I were to go ahead and show you a quick demonstration of this, switch to my gear here. One of the prerequisites for ensuring that there's a good instance of SQL available in the environment, one of the options is to use SQL Server's own sysprepping option. In SQL Server 2008 R2, you have the ability to sysprep the SQL instance. And then once that instance is sysprepped, you're able to sysprep the entire OS. So the image that you then create can then be instantiated into not just the operating system, but a specific SQL instance that you have determined during the sysprep option. And what I'm showing you here is just the option within the setup tool for SQL. If you go into the advanced option, you'll see this tool here, the link here for image preparation of a standalone instance of SQL Server. This is what you use to create that sysprepped image. When you do so, one of the things it is going to ask you for is not the instance name, but something called the instance ID. This instance ID is what you will use later on in your service templates. You can have one or more instance IDs within a SQL Server environment. So it is very important for us to distinguish between the instance name, which we're all familiar with, and the instance ID that we talk about quite frequently. So let me switch gears and show you what the systems management tool itself looks like. What you're seeing here is a live view, I'm talking back to my lab in Redmond, of Virtual Machine Manager, which is one of the components of System Center 2012. Virtual Machine Manager for those of you who are maybe familiar with something like ESX from VMware, is the equivalent, and a little bit more, of course, of what vCenter does for ESX. Virtual Machine Manager is the equivalent of what we do for not just hypervisor, our hypervisor, Hyper-V, but we can manage Citrix Zen Server as well as VMware's ESX using the same tool. And it's got a very Outlook-like UI where you've got all your key information in the center pane, some basic performance information on the lower panes for a given CPU, for a given virtual machine. What I'm listed here down this column is the names of virtual machines. I've got computer names, etc. And you can see I can get all kinds of information populated in these views right here. But one of the things I want to really focus on is how did I create these templates? Templates are stored in our parlance in what are known as libraries. A library is essentially a file share in your environment that hosts your ISO files, PowerShell scripts, sysprepped VHD files, anything that you need to create your virtualized environment. Unattended XML files, unattended text files, anything along those lines, ISO images. And part of what goes into the library are templates. There are various kinds of templates, one of which is the guest OS profile template. And for SQL Server, I've created a template which allows me to automatically increment the name of the virtual machine, the Active Directory name of that virtual machine by just providing the hash marks. So the reason I'm talking about this is so that you can get exposed to some of the ways that you can essentially automate and self-provision without having to worry about what the underlying naming convention is. Once you've determined what the naming convention is, you can templatize that using Virtual Machine Manager. You can also set up your product keys, admin passwords, and most importantly, you can go and set up what Windows Server roles you need for this specific instance of SQL Server. So anything that you see in Windows Server Manager, if you go into add roles, that same information is exposed through Virtual Machine Manager. You can see the list of roles and the list of features that are available. These are the same things that are available through Server Manager as well, but it allows you to automate things. You can join a machine to a domain. You can give either the domain credentials yourself or pre-select what we call a run-as account. And the run-as account is an important concept to understand. Remember we talked about the segregation of duties between the server admins and the DBAs? Typically, because of that separation of duty, the DBA may or may not have the privileges to join a machine to the domain. However, the server admin will have provided what is known as a run-as account, essentially proxying the information for you. So they will go ahead and provide the user ID and user password. That user ID and password is encrypted because the underlying infrastructure database, again, for Virtual Machine Manager is, of course, is SQL Server as well. So you can use SQL Server's own encryption mechanisms to encrypt all the information, passwords, credentials, everything else. So you can do that. You can provide answer files, GUI, run once commands, etc. This is what you do from a guest OS profile. You can also provide hardware profiles. I can have like a medium workload, a light workload, etc. And here's where I can define how much memory is needed, how much processors are needed, what is my maximum and minimum memory, what kind of networks I want to join this machine to. And pretty straightforward. If I want to make this machine highly available, and I'll try and zoom in here so you can see. If you want to make this machine highly available, all you have to do is click this checkbox. Right? Once you click this checkbox, the system automatically recognizes that I need to find a clustered environment in my private cloud. Remember that the private cloud may have clustered environments, it could have standalone environments. I, as the application owner or the person providing or using this template, need not care. I, frankly, that's really not my job. All I care about is I want my machine highly available. That's all I care about. So I can go ahead and set this checkbox, and it'll go and find machines out there that are clustered. The next thing I can do is set up what is known as SQL Server profiles themselves. There are two ways that you can set up a SQL instance. One is using the sysprepped version that I talked about. I've got a sysprepped SQL image, and then I've got the underlying operating system also that is sysprepped. I'm going to take that and use that sysprepped image as a base for my virtual machine. So if I look at the properties of that, within the SQL Server configuration, I can do things like provide the instance ID or the SQL instance name. This instance ID, in this case I've called it Hyper-V, is the instance ID I used when I sysprepped that instance of SQL. Make sense? This is where you would use that instance ID. You can also do things like configuration of the media source where you'll need to pull files from to install SQL. When you sysprep SQL, it still needs to have access to the media. So, and I can point to that. I can provide names for or credentials for my SQL Server administrators, for my SA accounts, and also determine how my connection is using name pipes or TCP/IP. And more importantly, I can set up my own SQL Server configuration file.
So I think this part's very important. So many individuals, I think a good use case for these service templates is, firstly, when working with some of our customers, people come back to us and say, in order for them to stand up a SQL Server installation from soup to nuts, meaning I provision the hardware, I order the hardware, I get the hardware placed in the data center, I get the hardware installed with the operating system, I get the SAN provision, I get the SQL Server installed, and the service pack installed, then the database, that process end-to-end could be 6 months. So the goal here is with a service template, you create an end-to-end installation of the Windows operating system, the SQL Server installation, right down to a DAC pack or the database, which we'll showcase also, within minutes, or a little longer than a couple minutes. But the goal here is with a configuration file, I can save information or generate a configuration file which includes all the information I want. So if I want standardized SQL Server installations, I want to deploy 1,000 of them, I can say I want the database engine, I want this specific service account, I want this specific component to be installed. I can create a configuration file by actually running it through a regular installation, and before I hit go, I have the ability to select that configuration file from the installation and then place it within the service template. So again, it's beneficial to utilize these service templates for end-to-end provisioning of the guest operating system, the SQL Server installation of the instance, and at the same time, the actual database if necessary. And then utilize a configuration file which can be generated through a command prompt or by saving the configuration file after I create a SQL Server installation.
So one of the things you can do is, let's say you've got a SQL Server INI file, configuration file that you can pre-populate here. That may be your standard INI file. What if I have something special I need for my super duper special application? Well, whatever I put in this UI here can be used to override what's in the INI file. If you want, you can choose to use just the INI file and not input any of these parameters here. That's fine. But if I do have an INI file and I want to override it, I can go ahead and add some parameters here. Similarly, I can provide all my service accounts, whether it's the SQL Server service account itself, the agent service, or even the reporting services accounts. These are all run as accounts or accounts that you can choose to provide credentials for yourself. So that's what you can have for a SQL Server deployment. Now, if I want, I can create additional SQL Server deployments as such, and you know, essentially stack multiple SQL Server deployments all in one template. The other thing I want to show you, the other way that you can actually create self-profile of SQL is by using what is known as an application profile. This, in my opinion, is somewhat more flexible way of installing not just SQL, but any application. Maybe you're using IIS, maybe you're doing a web deploy package. Any instance of IIS or SQL can be deployed using this methodology. The way I would do that is, again, choose to add either a SQL DAC pack, which Rod just talked about, or a web application, which would essentially be a web deploy package that you can pre-configure and use for your IIS instances.
I guess for those who are not familiar with the data to your application, the goal here would be I can extract the data to your application from SQL Server 2008 R2 and above, include the schema affiliated with that data to your application, and put it in the application template. Therefore, when I do deploy SQL Server, I can also deploy the specific databases I want automatically to that instance.
Now, what's also extremely powerful, and this is where you know I really start getting excited, is the ability to provide pre and post uninstall and install scripts. So let me go ahead and zoom in so you can see a little better. So I can do things like this, right? In this case, I've said I'm going to do a pre-install. In this case, all I have is a base OS, and I'm going to layer an application profile on top of it. When I layer an application profile on top of that base OS, the system, when it's deploying the operating system within the virtual machine, is going to lay down the OS. Then it is going to look for these other profiles. If it finds a SQL profile, it is going to lay that on top. If it finds an application profile, it's going to lay that on top. So in this case, what is the application profile doing? All it is doing is running command.exe with a quiet switch and running a command file called install sql.cmd, and I'm passing a parameter to this. This parameter is enclosed on either side by the at sign. I can have one or more parameters, right? All I'm trying to do is provide a mechanism by which I can templatize things like instance name, service account IDs, anything that is a switch in setup.exe for SQL, I'm able to parameterize. So that gives me immense power by which I can go to a form on a website, fill in those mandatory fields, click submit, and you know, go on a coffee break, come back, and have your virtual machines deployed. So one of the things I've done in this case, you know, I've mentioned that I've got this instance ID here. I'll show you what that command file actually looks like. So here's what it is, right? I've got my standard SQL setup.exe, and I've got all the switches that go along. And here's the interesting part. Right, and I've got the instance name equals %1. Where is that %1 coming from? It's coming from the instance ID that I parameterized using the at sign on either side. I can have %1, %2, %3, etc. in this setup.exe switch. Right, and everything that I have a percent against, I'm able to go back to my SQL my environment here, in this script, and let's say I wanted to put the password here. So all I'll do is say that password. Right, if I do that, I will need to have a %2 in the command file. And that %2 will be in the prompt for the password. So the way this will actually manifest itself is, again, in those service templates I talked about. The service template is nothing more than a conglomeration of various underlying templates. I'll give you a good example here of a multi-tier application. And I'll let this build out here for a second. A multi-tier application that can have one or more SQL tiers, a database tier, etc. So let me go ahead and zoom in here. And you're able to see I don't know if you can read this properly, but maybe I'll zoom out. Yeah, I'll try that. Let's try this.
There we go.
Right. So let's go ahead and show you what this really means, right? I've got this stock trader service. I'm able to configure that as multiple tiers, and each tier is essentially one of the templates that I can drag and drop from the left side here. I can drag and drop these templates that I'm seeing over to this service profile, and then I can go ahead and deploy this profile. So pretty powerful in terms of a robust multi-tier application. In this case, when I choose to create my SQL Server profile, I can even set up things like, remember that the parameter that I chose to get prompted was the instance name. I can go into the settings of the template and determine whether that instance name is has a default value, or whether that, or even if that is a mandatory field. So when I go in and try to deploy that using a self-service portal, and I'll show that in a second here. What I'm showing you here is a self-service portal that I will use as the end user, or maybe as a DBA, to provision what I've just been delivered through somebody who has already created those templates. When I do that, and let's say I want to deploy this particular service template, all I choose is deploy, and I will get a form that asks me which cloud, like I have one or many clouds in my environment, based on the capabilities of that cloud. I can choose that and then click OK, and then I'll get a view of what the service template is all about. In this service, if I click Configure, notice what is available here. SQL instance name, right? This is a parameter that I will enter. Then all I'll do is say deploy. And boom, I'm done. I'm done with deploying a SQL Server instance based on the information I provided, my SQL instance ID, my service account, passwords, whatever parameter I had using setup.exe. Okay?
So we want to quickly summarize what we showcased today. So the goal here is, if you're designing a private cloud infrastructure and you're trying to optimize SQL Server within the private cloud, we definitely showcase the different steps involved. So ultimately, from a planning perspective, we want you to utilize the MAP toolkit in order to get an inventory of your existing SQL Server environment. You can utilize the upgrade advisor. Therefore, if you are trying to standardize on a single platform, such as SQL Server 2012, on Windows Server 2008 R2, or upcoming on Windows 2012, you can definitely achieve these goals through these type of tools. In addition to that, the output of the SQL Server map report will help dictate how many cores you should purchase, how many Hyper-V hosts you should purchase to develop or to deploy the private cloud. In addition to that, the different storage layers affiliated with the private cloud solution. And then finally, what we're looking at is how do you achieve high availability? That can be done through live migration, guest clustering, or always-on availability groups, provided that you're moving towards SQL Server 2012. And the final piece, I believe, is very important, where a lot of our customers are talking to us about, is this whole self-service capability. So the goal here is to create a portal where you can have, or I could say you can liberate your business users. Therefore, they can go to this portal, they can request a specific SQL Server instance, including a database application if necessary. They can put the timeline they require the specific system for. They press a button, You approve it, and ultimately you're rapidly deploying the guest operating system, the SQL Server instance, in addition to that, the actual data to your application if necessary. And with that being said, if they're in a situation they only need that for 2 months, at the end of the 2 months through the workflow, you can automatically deprovision this environment and release those resources back up into the private cloud. So with that being said, I think I want to thank everybody for attending our session, and I want to open up the floor for any questions. We definitely want you to fill in the feedback forms. There's some additional resources online here.
Yeah, it'll be great if you could come to the mic. I'm happy to repeat the questions as well.
Yeah.
But we've got some time. We wanted to deliberately leave some time for questions. So if you have any, please.
Yeah, and if you don't have the opportunity to have a question with us today, I'll be down at the SQL Server booth and also at the Microsoft Press/O'Reilly booth doing some book signings at 1 o'clock. Shameless plug.
Thank you.
One thing that you got me confused is you start explaining SQL SysPrepped
right.
version, and then you mentioned that you need to say where the source media files for SQL are coming from.
Correct.
And also the command file to install SQL was not one to use SysPrepped version. It was to use plain from media install. So I kind of confused because you starting going to the SysPrepper version, but you didn't finish that, and you start talking about full SQL installation.
Right. So there are two ways that you can deploy SQL using Virtual Machine Manager. Right? One is using the SysPrepped instance of SQL. Okay. That does provide good capabilities in terms of assigning service accounts, configuration, SQL INI files, et cetera.
And I don't need, in this case, the SQL binaries because it's already in the
No,
PhD,
the way SQL SysPrep works is that it still needs access to the media.
Still needs.
It still needs access to the media. That's a SQL thing.
Specifically to complete the installation.
Yeah, it requires you to complete the installation. Okay. So irrespective of whether you're using the SQL Server service profile or the other method, which was the application profile that I talked about, in either case, you will need access to the media.
What would be the advantage then to use a SysPrepped version over
The SysPrep version is a good way to get started. The way I look at it is that the application profile way gives me a lot more flexibility beyond which what I can put in a, INI file. Whatever is in the INI file is essentially hard-coded. Whatever I want to override is only things that I can see in the UI. Service accounts, instance name, etc. What if I want to do something else that the setup.exe switch allows me to do, but the SQL Server profile is somewhat unable to do? In those instances, in this particular customer's case, that was the case. They needed more capability beyond what SysPrep provided. I used the setup.exe command line, and I used the application profile instead. So you can do either. The application provides you much more flexibility, in my opinion.
And one other thing, just to add to that also, would be if you utilize SysPrep, it does install some of the components ahead of time, and then you're completing the installation after the fact. So it may be a faster installation. However, that installation is pretty much standardized. Whereas if you use the service templates, the configuration file, you ultimately can choose and make changes on the fly without going back and changing your SysPrep image.
Okay. Just a last question.
Sure.
You mentioned you have a SQL best practices LUN document or configuration.
Okay.
Can you point out which document you're referring to?
So this is for the storage arrays. So if you go to whoever your storage vendor is, just go to your favorite search engine, Bing, of course, and type in Hyper-V best practices for EMC or Hyper-V best practices for NetApp or Hitachi, and you'll get a link to that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
How do you keep track of usage in relation to software licenses?
Correct. So in terms of the usage, we didn't have time to demonstrate another capability within system center that allows you to do, essentially utilize SQL Server's own analysis services to determine how much CPU is used on an overall cloud basis, how much disk space is used. What you end up doing is providing dollar values to those
self-destruct mechanisms turned on. How do you turn that off? But you also mentioned licensing, right? So I think even the Maps tool is a great way to understand your licensing components affiliated with what installations are out there.
So we can probably talk offline as well, and then I can get to any other questions.
So, repeat
the question, please.
Yeah, no problem. So how did you handle database migration in a specific environment? In general, we have a couple options available. We can conduct a P2V migration where you're just taking the SQL Server installation as is and going from a physical to virtual. We didn't do that in this specific case. We actually did a lot of consolidation and database migrations through that. So ultimately, the three options would be attach, detach, backup, and restore, and utilize the migration wizard within SQL Server to move the database and the related objects across. So ultimately, we did a combination of both in order to achieve those goals. Any other questions? Sir, you're by the mic.
How does it scale if you have multiple data centers in multiple countries?
So how does a private cloud scale if you have multiple data centers in multiple countries? I think a lot of times what I see here would be individuals will have more than one private cloud, and they may have one private cloud in a local data center and host databases within that specific environment for that specific geographic location. So let's say, for instance, you had a data center in North America, one in EMEA, one in APAC. You may have three private cloud environments, and then you store your SQL Server databases locally to that environment. From a scalability perspective, you can even take advantage of tools such as peer-to-peer replication. Therefore, if you want to distribute that database across three different private clouds, that's a possibility. Or you look at the different high availability disaster recovery technologies in play directly with SQL Server to allow that scalability. All right, thank you.
Great. Thank you, everyone.
All right, thanks, folks.